Outstanding, my friend. Welcome to the Edge.
Well, honored to be here.
Appreciate you coming on the program, man. This is the first time here, Doctor, and we're going to be talking about a variety of subjects. But before we get going, how about introducing yourself to our audience? Who you are, what you're about, what you do, that type of thing?
Certainly. In the vein of David Copperfield, I was born, I traveled, all that good stuff. Yeah, my name's Judd Burton. I hail from West Texas, a little town called Merkle. And I am a historian and anthropologist by training. Okay. I have a bachelor's degree in history from Hardin-Simmons University, master's degree in anthropology from Texas Tech, and a PhD in history from the same institution. And I'm an ancient historian of religion, if I want to get down to brass tacks, but I'm easily fascinated by all aspects of history, not just the antique past, but the prehistoric past, and even the medieval, early modern, and modern periods as well. And I've taught history, humanities, anthropology, religion in colleges and universities for over 20 years now. And I am thoroughly interested in the world of the Watchers and the Giants, which is probably a topic that your audience is familiar with in some capacity. But that in a nutshell is who I am, where I'm coming from. I've always been interested in history. I got bit by the archaeology bug pretty early on, and it never went away. Never went away. I just I pursued it as far as I could in terms of advanced degrees, and here I am, all those years later, still doing it.
Wow. Well, one thing for sure, I love prehistory myself, and you know, that's, it's just one of those things, Judd, that it was so, history in itself, it seemed like it was so prepackaged forever in this country.
Yeah.
You know, Columbus, you know, sailed the ocean blue in 1492. You know, or you know, man came from goo to a monkey to, you know, erectus homo,
sure,
or whatever. But yeah. Can I say that erectus homo? That doesn't sound right. But anyway, you know what I'm saying. I mean, it's prepackaged. But lately, more and more, the actual history is coming out, and I appreciate that you digging into it and getting some of this truth.
Well, you know, ostensibly that's how history and the humanities and social sciences are supposed to work. When new evidence comes along, it either is supposed to corroborate or peripheralize the previous, you know, paradigm. And I mean, that's the essence of what we're proposing, right, in terms of scientific pursuits. But the fact of the matter is that it doesn't really work that way in a lot of cases. You know, we both profess an interest in prehistory. I'm working on an article right now about Western Civ world history textbooks that really don't treat prehistory with very much care. It's more like a speed bump. You know, let's just get on to the traditional earliest civilizations, the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, the Indus River Valley. But we're finding out now, and this isn't just, you know, it's not just a flight of fancy. We're talking about decades of archaeological data, quantitative hard data on these sites like prehistoric Jericho and Tel Karamel in Syria and Chat Al Hayuk in Turkey and Göbekli Tepe in eastern Turkey. You know, Klaus Schmidt did 25 some odd years of archaeology at Göbekli Tepe, and Kathleen Kenyon literally wrote the book on almost all phases of Jericho, from prehistory all the way down to you know, down to the late Iron Age, I think. So, you know, if we're to judge civilizations by the criteria that we judge, let's say, the earliest city-states like, you know, Sumer and Eridu and some of those, then we have to come to the conclusion at the end of the day that these prehistoric sites in the late Pleistocene are in fact civilizations. They have stratification of labor, specialization of labor, stratification of society, the centralizing of their government, their religion is becoming more anthropomorphic, they have walled settlements in many cases. All of these criteria, if we're to use them as the standard criteria for civilization, then we have to admit at the end of the day that these early sites are in fact civilizations and predate the ones of antiquity. But that's not being done at all. In the textbooks that I reviewed, two of them spent much time on prehistory, and only one of them referenced sites like Göbekli Tepe and Çatal Hayık. Now, it's been almost 25 years since Klaus Schmidt broke ground at Göbekli Tepe, and it's been, you know, almost twice as long since Kathleen Kenyon started work at Jericho. You know, it's kind of like, academia, publishers, wake up. You know, if this is the way that scientific history is supposed to work, why aren't our textbooks being amended?
Mm-hmm. Right. And the thing of it is, they're not being amended. I mean, even when there's point blank empirical data that's been proved by various outlets, cultures, universities, they won't change it. It's like there's a message they want to give, and they're going to stick with that message no matter what the facts are.
Right. Exactly. I have my... Of course, I approach a lot of this material not only as a scholar, but I'm also subscribed to a biblical worldview. Just looking at the Bible, just bare bones, if I could use the pun, there's a lot of archaeological and text evidence to support the veracity of the historical narrative of the Bible. Not to say that that's not true of some other texts, but you seem to have orders of magnitude more in terms of the Bible. But even that aside, something like a celestial being or a hybrid being of angelic and human pedigree completely blows the Darwinian paradigm out of the water. Mm-hmm. It completely changes what we would understand as the nature of reality and what was possible. Here's another contention that, if corroborated, would completely rewrite the standard narrative of history. And I've cited one rather, not necessarily fantastical, but it's supernatural possibility. And the other comes from quantitative data, actual archaeological data. And it's a great frustration to me as a historian to see that these narratives are not being amended in the way that our field is supposed to be applying rigor, and you have to ask why at the end of the day.
Well, that is the question, why. There seems to be, I guess I do like to use the word conspiracy, but it does seem there's a larger effort behind this, and it is, of course, to start with evolution in the public schools. Of course, now we've digressed into 15 genders and various other things that are sort of rewriting science and ignoring empirical science data. That really, if you come to the purest science, Dr. Burton, is that a truth that cannot be changed. When you replicate something in a scientific test, they say if you replicate it, then it's a truism. But there is truth that is out there, that there's, for instance, two genders, but now there's 15. And even though science says there can't be more than two, they're saying there is. It's the same thing with sort of history, is that there is a history, but it's not their history. It is the history that is that the relics and the data and the even archaeological digs have found prove there's something, there's another history that's not being taught, and they keep saying this is the history. It's the sort of same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think you hit on a very good point that we're dealing with the consequences of jettisoning objective truth from education. And it really started when we began to peripheralize the classical tradition in education, the old trivium and quadrivium system. But it was based on the classical virtues of pursuing what is good, what is beautiful, and what is true. Well, along comes postmodernism in the 50s and 60s and completely changes the paradigm and says there is no objective truth. Mm-hmm. Or my truth is as true as your truth, mm-hmm. whether it's actually true or not. Mm-hmm. Postmodernism did and continues to do a great disservice to not only K through 12 education, but higher education as well. Postmodernism, in my opinion, has completely gutted higher education, mm-hmm. and to where scholars like myself, who are, you know, tend to be more open-minded and in terms of any pursuit, any question, pursuing a truth should be fair game, but that's almost illusory today in higher education. I think that Ben Stein did a really good job with his documentary Expelled, where he looked at these professors who were, some of them didn't even espouse intelligent design. They were simply referencing the research that had been done in intelligent design. Mm-hmm. And a number of them lost their jobs, had their tenure revoked. Mm-hmm. Why?
Yeah.
I mean, philosophically, that makes absolutely no sense. If academia, if higher education is supposed to be the bastion, of academic free speech, if you will, mm-hmm. why mm-hmm. Yet another question, why were these people let go? Why was their tenure revoked? Why were their careers and lives destroyed? Mm-hmm. Because they were pursuing a question.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big X-Files fan, still am a big X-Files fan, and there's something that Mulder said one time that really, it really distills that kind of questioning down to the button. And he told Scully one time, he said, this is the essence of science. You ask an impertinent question and you're on your way to a pertinent answer. I'm not convinced that philosophy exists in mainstream academia anymore.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, where do you teach at now?
Well, I had been teaching at South Texas College, mm-hmm. in McAllen, Texas.
Is that a public university?
It is. I've recently actually, I resigned my post there and am now devoting all my research energies and attention to a kind of think tank that I've been building up over the last few years called the Institute of Biblical Anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
Where I can pursue, you know, a wider berth, you know, mm-hmm. That's my goal is to try and rebuild those standards.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. And the reason I asked about the public part of it is, did you have pressure to stay the course, stay within the system, say what they want to say? Did you have educational freedom, or did you find that they had restrictions on you?
It's not necessarily that I felt now in other institutions across the country, you know, I hear my peers and colleagues talking about it all the time. I was fortunate in that I had some good colleagues who even if they didn't agree with me, respected the quest. In other words, they respected the pursuit, the scholarly pursuit. Mm-hmm. That being said, I kept seeing a lot of students not all of them, because I've always had good students. You know, some students are just going to learn anyway because they're hungry. But I kept finding more and more students who were not, and were not really prepared for the kinds of rigor that was expected of them. Mm-hmm. So it was a combination of things. I did feel some pressure because I was surrounded by a body of thinkers that had been liberalized by postmodernism, mm-hmm. and in that sense, hostile is probably not the right word for the environment, but maybe abrasive mm-hmm. Certainly was.
Well, maybe a little sort of toxic, yeah. There. All right, hey.
Yeah, exactly.
Toxic. All right, we've got a number of questions coming in from our chat, our YouTube chat, Doctor. We'll start with this one here. And, of course, in the background here we have Interview with Giants, one of your books. Stack Stevenson asks, will Giants walk the earth again?
That's a great question. I always think of Jesus' sermon in Matthew chapter 24, where he makes this seemingly cryptic statement about the days of Noah, when he says, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. I've been asked about that for years and years. My response to it is, if Jesus was simply talking about, the surprise, the shock that it would be when he came back, he could have picked any number of Old Testament references to illustrate that. After all, he was a rabbi, but he chose the days of Noah. And if you look at the days of Noah, things were going downhill very fast, mm-hmm. and it was still the world of the Watchers, mm-hmm. and the pre-flood giants. As well as the other kind, there's a lot of flexibility in the interpretation of the word Nephilim. It can mean giant. There are cognates in other languages like Aramaic where it specifically means giant. But it can mean all sorts of things. Fallen ones is typically how it's translated. But it was applied to all kinds of giants and chimerical creatures. We get a glimpse of from apocryphal literature like the Book of Enoch. I'm not a prophet, nor am I the son of a prophet or necessarily a prognosticator, but Jesus' statement there seems to indicate that, all of those conditions at some point will be returning. Mm-hmm. So that would be my answer.
Mm-hmm. All right. Steve Ells asked this question. Could we be the giants and the elves and the fairies be the real people on the planet?
That, too, is another great question. I say this, my colleagues in physical anthropology and bioarchaeology and fields like that, paleontology, putting together the fossil record is a... It's a conjectural sort of thing. We do the best that we can, but we have to admit at the end of the day that there must have been species that walked on this planet at one point in time that completely defy imagination. And the more we peel back the strata, the more that we learn about that. Mm-hmm. Even in our own day. We still discover new species that we either thought were extinct or they are new species that we haven't encountered before. Mm-hmm. I've often said that the pre-flood world probably looked a lot like Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm. so it's entirely possible. Mm-hmm.
I want to kind of follow up on something you mentioned earlier. You talk about the existence or possible existence of chimeras and other type of things. When you're looking at Greek mythology, and when you're talking about, say, centaurs and various creatures and gods and various things, do you think that pre-flood, because you mentioned prehistory as well, that they had the technology to merge DNA and construct chimeras and various human-animal hybrids?
I think that's one of the things that we have to conclude, again, from the, you know, if we're to take the apocryphal literature like Enoch and Jasher and Jubilees and, you know, some other stuff from the Dead Sea Scrolls like the Genesis Apocryphon, if we're to take those as a more detailed glimpse into the pre-flood world, then yeah, I would say that the technology was there. That seems to have been the exchange when the accounts that we have of the Watchers, or the Sons of God, as they're called in the Genesis account, the Benach Elohim. If we're to take that as a more detailed account, then that's the exchange that was made, is access to the human genome, you know, the taking of wives, mm-hmm. in exchange for this combination of practical sciences and occult sciences, you know, astronomy, meteorology, things like that, mixed mm-hmm. with, you know, witchcraft and sorcery. And I think that the technology was there, because it says that they corrupted not only human flesh, but they corrupted the animals and the birds, the beasts of the field, the reptiles. Right there is your recipe for the chimerical creatures that you find in Greek mythology, like you mentioned, like the centaurs and the satyrs. But you also find these creatures, you know, in mythology and folklore all around the world.
Mm-hmm. All right. Another question. Are all the religious books corrupted by the controllers of information?
I would say that they're all valuable in the kind of nuggets of mythology that they provide. Again, I subscribe to a Judeo-Christian worldview, so I tend to think that those associated with the Jewish and Christian tradition, early Christian tradition of the Bible, not so much. But you know, even religious texts, including the Bible, are subject to translations that are, let's say, politically motivated, you know,
mm-hmm, right.
Or if you get a commission of translators their theology isn't necessarily orthodox, then you do have some translations out there that sort of bend the cultural context, in fact, the language in which they were written. Mm-hmm. To an extent, the question that the caller asked, in fact, these texts can be manipulated, mm-hmm. and the Bible is not immune to those sorts of machinations, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I think the old American Standard is probably the best, closest translation to the original stuff. That is the Tanakh, the Hebrew Tanakh, and the Greek New Testament.
Mm-hmm. Somebody wrote in and said, is not pure science always changing with the evidence? And I guess when you talk about truth, it seems to me there's only one truth. And no matter what the subject is, there can only be one truth. There can't be variations of truth.
Exactly.
But if evidence comes and says that a previously known truth is changed a little bit, then can't we say that it never was the truth?
Well, this brings us back to our discussion at the beginning of the show, you know, that the way that... the pursuit of knowledge, science or philosophical pursuit of knowledge, is supposed to work, is that, if something comes along that definitively and repetitively disproves the previous paradigm, then it should replace it. There is a new truth.
Mm-hmm. There's you have the pyramids, which is always pointed to as sort of iconic, that humans could not have built that to the precision that it was built. Of course, now regular science says it was a bunch of guys with ropes and bricks and stone and wood rollers, you know,
right.
And you know, putting on ships and carrying up 500 miles from the original destination of the quarry. But others say that it may be harmonic machines of some sort, some kind of levitation machines, built that. But that's that anomaly stands out there as iconic as it is. There are those type of structures all over the planet, including under the sea. Why doesn't it make sense to alter? And you kind of alluded to this earlier, that even though we find evidence, like I didn't think off the sea in Japan, isn't there like gigantic structures, concrete, like just perfectly straight edged concrete out in the middle of the ocean there?
Right. And there's still, you know, the mainstream geologists say that it's a natural formation, and then you've got other people saying that it's not. It could easily be an underwater structure. I mean, we, you know, when lakes and seas, you know, when the levels of those bodies of water change, you know, we routinely as archaeologists find, you know, all kinds of information. Even when they don't, with nautical archaeology, you can do a lot. We know a lot about the prehistoric coastline of the Black Sea, for instance. When its sea level was lower, the coastlines were heavily populated. So it's entirely possible, yeah, that these underwater structures are in fact, you know, man-made or designed anyway. Mm-hmm.
But again, my premise there, of course, is that would change the history.
You know, absolutely.
And like you said, they just won't do it. We have this question from One and One, and it says, why would anyone want to hide the fact that there were giant people? What benefit would it serve?
Well, again, you know, I would allude to my previous statement that these sorts of creatures would, you know, completely blow out the old standard Darwinian paradigm. Plus, you add to that, I mean, that right there it's a scientific blow, right? Okay, mm-hmm. You'd have to completely scrap, you know, Darwinian evolutionary theory and all of its, you know, and all of its avatars, all of its incarnations, so to speak. But I think another thing is that the proof of the existence of such creatures, which I think there are three axes of proof. There's mythological proof, there's historical document-based proof, and the sparsest of those evidences would be the physical, the archaeological, but it is there. But the standard proofs for these kinds of creatures would also go a long way towards corroborating mythological traditions around the world of giants. And thirdly, they would add, you know, in addition to all the textual, all the historical, archaeological evidence that supports the veracity of the Bible, it would also add even more historical veracity to the biblical narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, you know, the proof of their existence is a giant threat, you know, to pardon the pun, but it is a giant threat to many sectors.
Mm-hmm. Right. It undermines their storyline.
Sure.
In our Facebook post of this interview for tonight, I grabbed something from your website, and I'm going to butcher this word, Judd. But let's see, paraethnology.
Oh, paraethnology. Yes.
I didn't do too bad, did I?
No, not too bad at all.
I never heard of that word, and when I Googled it, your name come up. Did you coin that term?
I think that I must have coined that term. Ethnology, of course, is essentially synonymous with cultural anthropology. It's the broad comparative study of human cultures. And, you know, I thought, this is a methodology that I know, you know, using anthropological models. And I began to, I've applied that to the study of giants, but also in a broader sort of way, to other kinds of paranormal phenomena as well. And I'm about to put out a little primer on paraethnology, which of course would be the sort of anthropological or ethnological study of paranormal phenomena mm-hmm. from a qualitative sort of standpoint. So that in essence is what paraethnology is. It's a paranormal focus of a cultural anthropological attack.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. Like I said, I'm about to put out a primer, a reader on that very thing.
Okay. Barbara Briggs asked, says, Jed, are you going to have a service tomorrow?
A service?
Yeah.
No, I am a minister, but I've actually not thought about. I'm guessing that that's what she's talking about is the mm-hmm. church service. Mm-hmm. I've actually not thought about that. Mm-hmm. I'll have to give that some thought.
Mm-hmm. Doreen, 8951. Doctor, do you have any evidence of Nibiru in your studies?
Well, Nibiru is an interesting topic in and of itself. Usually, people, when they hear or discuss Nibiru, they immediately think of Zachariah Sitchin's work. And Nibiru... typically, now I'm not saying that there can't be a rogue planet or Planet X, you know, that, you know, our astronomical knowledge is growing leaps and bounds literally every day, you know, every minute of every day. So it's possible that there's a rogue planet, you know, on some trajectory that we haven't yet discerned. That being said, Nibiru in the Sumerian literature, whether it's, you know, take your pick, the fragmentary stuff that we have, or, you know, the flood epics or literature about the gods like Marduk, wherever you find the word, it's almost universally talking about the planet Jupiter, which Mesopotamians called Marduk's star. The interpretation of it being a rogue planet, again, largely comes from Zechariah Sitchin, who was a good writer, but he was not, I don't believe that he was really qualified to make some of the conclusions that he did about Nibiru. They were just simple. In a lot of cases, it was simple mistranslations. I'm not saying that he didn't know a lot about Sumerian mythology, but in terms of the mechanics of the language itself, he seems to make some pretty glaring errors that a simple grammar text would have, you know, Sumerian grammar, which there are several, a number of which the Sumerians actually wrote themselves. So in terms of Nibiru being a planet X or a rogue planet, I think it's pretty clear that the Mesopotamians are talking about Jupiter. But that, again, that's not to say that there isn't a planet X or a rogue planet.
Here's a great question. Could the giants be right beside us now in another frequency or dimension and be invisible?
Now that is an interesting question. I'm going to say it's possible. You know, it's a qualified yes, because again, we're dealing with, if you go back to the Nephilim, you know, the pre-flood giants, the original ones, you're dealing with a mixed pedigree, angelic pedigree and human DNA. So right there, the trans-dimensional legacy, if you will, would be part of the biology of these creatures, and there's no telling what sort of powers that befuddle mm-hmm. our science mm-hmm. That they had.
Yeah.
Now, as to could they be around us? Well, I think that they literally are, mm-hmm. Because again, if we're to believe Enoch and some of the other Dead Sea Scroll sources, at least part of the demonic hierarchy is comprised of the disembodied spirits of the pre-flood giants, and ostensibly any of the other giants that died even after the flood, like the tribes like the Rephaim, the Anakim, the Zamzamim, the Avim. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because the pronouncement that of judgment on the giants and the watchers that Enoch makes in that little passage, he talks about these spirits being unclean spirits. And in the New Testament, from Matthew to Revelation, this is one of the more common terms for demon. it's a little article that goes before the word pneuma, which is the word for spirit, and it means, you know, negative or unclean spirit. So, yeah, that's a great question and a great point, because they literally are, you know, around us. If you want to couch it in terms of a different frequency, then certainly.
Well, biblically, the scripture says we are surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And I remember there's another one where Paul said, I ascended, and I don't know whether I was in the body or out of the body. So there are definitely seems to be another realm that's right in our presence that we can't see. And I'm wondering if the cloud of witnesses is in that same dimension or frequency. And if so, is it a different one than, say, where the giants are? And their technology to inhabit that, whatever they created to inhabit that that realm.
You would think so. I mean, implicitly, the well, not just implicitly, but explicitly, you know, the Bible gives us the language of interdimensionality. We're just now beginning to understand that in terms of you know, quantum physics. Which is a little, you know, that's a little far afield from my expertise, but what I can read of it is, and I think Chuck Missler actually did a really good job of bringing this to light, is that, you know, when the Bible talks about the third heaven, the second heaven, the first heaven, you call it whatever you want to, but again, you can apply the Appalachian dimensions to those realms, if you will. Mm-hmm. But I would. My gut tells me that you would be dealing with, in terms of the frequency or dimension that the demons were in, would be different than the witnesses.
Mm-hmm. Or be a hell of a fight. But it sounds to me, though, that at some point, when Jesus comes with 10,000 of his saints, sounds like there's going to maybe those two realms meet, and that's where that clash is.
I think so, and you know, that reminds me of the incident in Genesis with the Tower of Babel. You know, this was a, you know, in Babel in some of those Mesopotamian dialects means the gate of the gods. So what Nimrod and his ilk were trying to accomplish was a storming of heaven. Right. So again, you can call this a technology or magic or whatever you want to. I mean, we're really using interchangeable terms here. Just, you know, they had the ability or they were trying to develop the ability, probably based on the watcher knowledge that was given to humanity, or trying to literally storm heaven and dethrone Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And of course, he wasn't going to have that. That's mm-hmm. when he split up all the languages. Mm-hmm. We can get into that later if you want to. But yeah, everything seems to be pointing to that, to a breakthrough in these dimensional barriers.
Isn't there a scripture that says that Satan wants to ascend and sit on the throne of God and be worshipped as God? I mean, so it seems to me there's that desire to dethrone God and for Satan to take his place has been there for a very long time. We have a question coming from George. It says, how many giants do you think made it through the flood?
Well, you know, I don't think that any of them made it through the flood. I suppose that some of them could. There are certainly some interesting stories in Jewish folklore. There's a story about Og, who is mentioned in the Torah as the king of Bashan. You know, Og's bed is probably one of the more famous stories associated with giants in the Bible, which is supposed to be about 13 feet long. But according to this folk story in Jewish folklore, Og basically hitched a ride on the ark by clinging to the outside of it. He supposedly told Noah that he was going to be a good boy after the flood, and Noah let him hitch a ride. Wow. Now, again, that's not canon.
Mm-hmm, right.
Is it possible that around the world there could have been? Probably not. But again, the scriptures are pretty clear about, most of the created world being laid waste during the Noahic flood.
Mm-hmm. Azur asks from the chat, could Antarctica be off limits due to the possibility that these giants are being held there by God, ready to be unleashed in his timeline.
Wow. Antarctica is a whole other bucket of worms. Again, I suppose it's possible. You know, we hear things about what they're finding, you know, underneath the ice in Antarctica all the time. You know, these pyramidal structures that you read about sometimes. So it's entirely possible. I don't discount anything anymore, and very little surprises me.
Do you know who Mike Adams is, Health Ranger?
I don't think so.
Okay, what about Steve Quell?
Steve Quell.
I heard an amazing or fascinating conversation between Mike Adams and Steve Quell. Mike Adams was saying that beings are preparing this planet for repopulation of their kind, which they are from a colder planet, and that's why what's going on in Antarctica is happening. But they say, although the left is saying that, you know, there's climate change in that the Earth is heating up, that really what they're trying to do is reduce the temperature through chemtrails, deflecting the sunlight, and through the reduction of carbon dioxide to lower the temperature down, because these beings want a colder planet when they begin to repopulate. It's a fascinating subject there. Let's get to another question for you. I said, are the demons the spirits that were in the giants before they were banished?
Yes, I believe so. Again, you know, if we're to look at Enoch as a dependable source, then I would say yes. And I think linguistically that's supported by the choice of words that Jesus and the apostles and the early church fathers used. The very wording that they used mimics the sentiment in the apocryphal works. So yes, I would say that you're talking about the spirits of these giants that were killed in the flood. Just consider modern cases of exorcism and people that claim to be possessed or demonized, whatever word you choose to put on it. They exhibit immense strength. They have knowledge that they're not supposed to have. They speak multiple languages. When you throw in the Nephilim contingent in this, then it begins to make sense that these things that have been around for eons have had all this time to gather this knowledge. So of course, you know, these people are going to exhibit those sorts of features, those sorts of characteristics, while under the influence of those spirits.
Are these demons giving humans the technology of our own enslavement?
That is a frightening question to ponder, at least an unnerving one. In part, I would have to say yes, probably, because we're at the point now where, when you consider the things that we can do, again, alluding back to quantum technology, quantum computing, for instance, if you look into quantum computing, the way that the processors are supposed to work is they have, instead of using just regular binary language, they literally dump the sort of questioning part of the equation for computing into another dimension for the computing to take place and then extract it back.
Right.
Now, that sounds like magic. I mean, when you think about it, it really boggles the mind. The super colliders, you know, most people know about CERN, but there are super colliders all over the world. You know, we have some here in the United States. I think they just fired up the one in Tennessee here not too long ago. But when you have, you know, one of the most reputable physicists on the planet, Stephen Hawking, saying, "Don't turn these things on because you might develop artificial singularities, black holes, that could, you know, swallow up the planet." The kinds of things that we're doing in genetic sciences today, it all it not only boggles the mind, but a lot of it harkens back to the, you know, the sort of Genesis 6 Book of Enoch stuff that's going on. So my answer to that question would be, I have a hard time thinking the opposite. I think that it's been going on for a while. Just look at the last 100-150 years of world history. For eons, we were hunter gatherers, and then suddenly, in about the 12th millennium BC, our cultural trajectory changes course about 90 degrees. And within the last 150 years, we've gone from horse and buggy to launching spacecraft into deep space.
Doctor, let me ask you something. That technology that you just mentioned, talking about the quantum computing operating in another dimension, is it possible that that technology right there is technology, say, that Jesus used to walk on water or to walk through a wall and appear to the disciples? Do you think it's unlocked God technology?
I think that, again, you know, you can use the word technology if you want to. I think that it was just inherent in him, because you're looking, you know, at a part of the Godhead.
He was able to
do that with ease. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but there must have been something, let's just say walking through a wall, for it to materialize, walking through a wall, that his body, which was a human body, an organic body, went through a wall. I guess somebody would say that's magic, or that, you know, that's God. But perhaps there was, and technology seems like too small of a word, but something that reorganizes particles, almost like the Star Trek transporter in the other side.
There would be
a principle involved there, would there not?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, if you want to, the physics of Jesus, yeah, absolutely, there would be something, yeah. It sort of baffles our understanding of how physics works, but yeah, absolutely, there would be a physics of the supernatural.
All right. I've had it several times in the background, Book of Giants, and has your name on it. Did you write the Book of Giants, or is that your version? What's in that book?
No, that's I have several edited volumes that I've worked on, and that's just one of the edited volumes
that I
have.
Okay, because somebody thought about that. So what are your thoughts on the actual Book of Giants?
Well, the Book of Giants is, for the longest time, we thought that it was used only by these kind of Gnostic sects, the Manichaeans. In fact, I think the original, the one that I edited here, that it's based on, was actually found in Asia, China, maybe. I think maybe Western China, amongst a sect of these Manichaeans. And that all changed. That is, its religious and cultural context changed in beginning in 1947, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, and we found actual fragments of the document kept with this corpus of documents that the Essenes had authored and collected. Not authored altogether, because there were books of the Old Testament too, like Daniel and Psalms and things like that, Isaiah, things like that. But it was a part of this Jewish tradition.
Where do the archons fit into this picture?
Well, the archons are I believe that's an allusion to Ephesians 6, where Paul is talking about the different kinds of the kind of demonic hierarchy, and archon is one of the words he uses, and it's a ruler over a geographical region. Now, if you look into any of the scholarship on the Divine Council, for instance, some of the work that Mike Heiser has done, by the way, he does a good job of illustrating what the Bible talks about in terms of gods, these Elohim, that were put in, were given literal geographical localities, nations, if you will. And you get glimmers of it in the Old Testament, like in the story of Moses when, you know, I forget exactly where the verse is, but it says, this very night God, or Yahweh, has done battle with the gods of Egypt. Mm, wow. Well, that's who he's talking about. He's talking about these mm-hmm. these principalities, these higher, or in this case, these higher order gods that were sort of set over these nations. Mm-hmm. Again, just like the angelic hierarchy, there's a fallen angelic hierarchy too, and the archons fit in that. Mm-hmm. And some of them would be these unclean spirits. Mm-hmm. who are given smaller chunks of these geographic localities.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't there in the Old Testament too, somebody prayed and then said there was a battle, and so the answer was delayed because there was a battle in the heavens between maybe.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. I think you're referring to the passage in Daniel about the Archangel Michael. Mm-hmm. Who said that he had been delayed from helping mm-hmm. the Jews in Babylon because he had been battling with the Prince of Persia,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is one of the appellations of a lot of scholars think he's talking about Lucifer, the chief of these archons.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to you can see the background that I'm in.
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to show you this here. I'm sure you're quite familiar with this here, and not to be salacious, I want to ask a question.
Sure.
Of course, there were giants in those days. Now, here, there's that scripture. What are the mechanics then of this picture, which I'm going to bring up, which is an ancient painting of a giant? Of course, there's a woman there, and I don't know if that is an accurate depiction of how big the giants were, but when mechanically, is there a difference in the giants coming into the daughters of men, say, we would say from the physical standpoint, which doesn't seem to be an impossibility, is there another sort of impregnation or coming into the woman that is not biological, as we would think from this type of picture here?
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up some good points. I think that a clear distinction should be drawn between the watchers. On one hand, the watchers slash sons of God, and their progeny, the Nephilim or the giants, on the one hand. This depiction here in this painting may have more to do with the fact that the giants were cannibals. I see some herd animals there too. Enoch speaks of the pre-flood giants consuming all of the resources of humanity. Mm-hmm. But in the case of the watchers, whether it was the physical sexual act or some sort of artificial insemination, we have an indication that the watchers were taller than humans, but that their progeny grew to be L's is the measurement that's used in Enoch, which were, you know, is still controversial as to what exactly an L is. But even if you're talking about, you know, something that's hundreds of feet tall, you're going to run into some morphological challenges in terms of procreation. So, yeah, I think the initial act may have been physical on the part of the watchers, but subsequent acts may have depended entirely on the kinds of genetic sciences, genetic knowledge that the watchers and the early giants had.
Mm-hmm. How far back in your studies have you been able to go? How far back in human history have you went?
Well, again, you know, my training goes back. My anthropological training. I've got all the sort of human biological history, you know, that allegedly goes back, or I should say hominid, which would include humans, that goes back, you know, millions of years. I think the fossil record is very problematic, and I have issues with that, but most of my prehistoric research has brought me to the late Pleistocene era, you know, the Mesolithic and the early Neolithic periods, which stretch back to about 12,000 BC in terms of when the Mesolithic begins. That just means the Middle Stone Age, because it's when you start to see those sites like Göbekli Tepe and Natufian Jericho and Çatalhöyük being established. That's the point when agriculture emerges, when people start, you know, making this transitioning from hunting and gathering to, Vir Gordon Childe called it the Neolithic Revolution because it offered a new way of social organization. It wasn't just that people had more dependable food sources, but now those food sources could sustain greater populations and a village that didn't move, one that stayed in one place. Mm-hmm. It just seems like something very significant, and I think that demonstrably so, something happened where this body of knowledge was interjected into human society.
Right.
During that time period, that completely changed our cultural trajectory. Mm-hmm. And if you take that time from 12,000 BC until the modern period, that's a very small chunk of geologic history. Mm-hmm. And certainly a small, you know, as far as humans and hominids have been around, that's a very small piece of time. Mm-hmm. For these sorts of changes to occur in human society.
Yeah.
I do go back to prehistory, and I've been focusing quite a bit on that lately.
You brought that right into the question that I had, and I'm going to follow up with you on. You basically said that there was a sort of a jump. I believe, and many people believe, that we are being prepared culturally to accept the idea that disclosure is near. And we are being acclimated to the fact that they are there, and with that, the revelation that they were the ones, they're going to say, we have come back to see what we have done, how you have progressed. Is there anything in your studies that can disprove that empirically says that did not happen or could not happen, and that it was more of a sort of a godlike thing, or perhaps maybe from the Nephilim, you know, from the biblical standpoint thing, say, versus an alien component?
Right. I think that scenario is very likely, actually. I haven't found anything in my research, particularly in pop culture. You know, I like to keep my finger on the pulse speed of pop culture. If you look at the kinds of literature, you know, books that are popular, especially the kinds of series and movies that are popular, you know, it just seems like everything is geared to, you know, even something that would seem innocuous, you know, like the Justice League or the Avengers or something. Mm-hmm. They're dealing with these huge alien or interdimensional threats that are coming to the planet, or they're setting us up to be, you know. I go all the way back to, you know, the day the Earth stood still, you know, and movies like Independence Day, you know, and series like V. If you look at this, there's a common thread, those images and ideas become symbols, and they become a kind of language or code that stays with us. Another thing that you notice is that a lot of series make heroes out of things that were once villains, you know, like vampires and werewolves and things like that. I think that that's a disturbing trend too, and I think that it also goes back to postmodernism. You know, these things were once classically. They were called out for what they were, you know. They were enemies and evil and all that. And now, when truth is relative, anything goes, including, you know, these benefactors returning to check on us from beyond. So I think that that's not only a scenario that's possible, but it's one that's been written about by a number of researchers.
Let me ask them. I don't know what the word is, and I don't even know if there's a word for it, because you were talking about transmitting information. The idea that there was a cataclysmic worldwide flood, and the generations that followed that knowledge, I don't know how it's transmitted biologically or genetically or encoded, but it seems to be some sort of encoding that we know innately, and we can't say where it's coming from or how we know that happened, and even perhaps the crucifixion of Jesus, that we innately know that somehow it's transmitted. We don't know where it is, but it's in there. And then sometimes, say, when we hear a gospel presentation, it opens that knowledge. It touches that memory that's in there, wherever it is, and therefore we have this massive emotional, for some of us have, or some of us would have had, you know, this emotional outburst there, or this sort of, people even say born again, which seems like it just acknowledging all that truth back from eons of time is true, what God said, and we realize it, and it hits us at one time. Is there a word for that? And do you know what I'm talking about? Can you talk about
that
a little bit?
I think as a species, I think we're hardwired, number one, to be religious. Just in general terms, we're hard, you know, that old saying, the axiom about, you know, people are going to worship something, whether it's, you know, gods or God or themselves or money or whatever, people are going to worship something. And so I think that we're hardwired to that. And I think that the fact that religion is such a universal and driving force in human cultures, I think, speaks to that. Now, in terms of a coding in our very being, that there are certain things that we just know. We know, you know, that there's a right and wrong. We know that innately we were created. We know that we need help. We need salvation because we can't be redeemed. There's a sense that creation is corrupted and needs redeeming. I think all of you hit on some good points, that all of those are innate. And I think that to a degree, not necessarily in a theological sense, but I think a lot of neuroscientists and philosophers and psychologists have worked on this in recent years in a subfield called neurotheology, in which we, you know, there's a biological component to spirituality that you can even quantify by monitoring the imagery of the brain when people are praying, and the kinds of chemicals and things that are produced. But outside of that, yes, I think that I think that we're hardwired not only for those sorts of general religious inducements, but I think that we're also specifically hardwired to know and to in an innate way and to realize that the narrative presented in the Bible is it's the completion in a lot of ways of what we need. When you consider the various elements of not only the Old Testament but especially in the New Testament, you consider how many, you know, that there's a creator God, there's Yahweh. He has a divine council, his angels. Humanity became corrupted by this political coup, if you will, in heaven, and needed a redemption. You needed a Messiah to clean all that up. You find all of those elements in world religion. You know, the sacred king, the Rex Sacrorum, in Roman tradition, and the savior of the world, you know, that's killed or crucified. You know, there's it's Osiris and Horus in Egyptian religion, and it's Odin, you know, spirit of the world tree in Norse mythology. But all of those, you know, if you consider that Lucifer had a broad spectrum of what was happening and what he could see farther down the road. He plants all these things around the world, but they're all facsimiles of the real thing. And when Jesus is crucified, he offers something that no other religion does. He offers not only salvation, but this personal relationship. In other words, you don't have to go through sacrificing doves and goats and all that stuff. You know, I'm the intermediary here, and all you have to do is assent to my proposition. But all of these other symbols you see showing up in world tradition as a kind of distraction. By the time you get to the first century AD, when Jesus arrives on the scene. That may be more of an answer than you wanted, but yeah, in essence, we're, you know, in a general sense, we are hardwired biologically, spiritually, mentally, to have a gut feeling about all these things.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you had asked the question, will there be a second incursion?
I think that there was a second incursion. I think when the passage of in Genesis chapter 6 says that there were giants on the earth and also afterwards, you know, inferring there that the afterwards part is after the flood. Now, there are a few theories as to how this could have happened. I personally believe that there were other angelic incursions after the flood, because if you think of Lucifer's, you know, coup in heaven, you know, just like a lot of other, if you think of it in terms of political or revolutionary movements or what have you, he may not have, we don't have any indication that all of the angels sided with him at the same time. So there may have been other factions that came along later. And I think that that goes a long way towards explaining the later tribes of giants, like the Rephaim, the Anakim, the Zamzumim. There are others who claim that one of Noah's sons' wives, you know, had giant DNA in them or something, and that's how the giants after the flood were born. I tend to believe that the former is the case and not the latter. But again, if you're talking about another incursion of giants, you know, if Jesus' statement in Matthew chapter 24 is an explicit one, then I think you have to conclude that there will be and may already be that underway.
In your book, Interview with the Giants, what is that about? Are you explaining what giants are? Or?
Well, Interview with the Giant is it's the application of anthropological models to the study of giants. It's not that the material that I was dealing with is necessarily new material, but I thought that there were other insights, other conclusions that could be teased out of it, and I didn't really see anybody using anthropological tools like ethnohistory to do that. Ethnohistory is basically used by anthropologists to either to piece together a cultural history of a people that are dying out or have recently or even in the past died out. You're basically getting all of the data that you can, whether it's folk tales or music or maps or historical records or archaeology. You're getting everything you can to make a more complete picture. And in a way, Interview with the Giant, and I entitled it Interview with the Giant because of the, you know, the anthropologist interviewing his or her subjects. Mm-hmm. The book was a kind of precipitate from my dissertation. I wrote my dissertation on a site that I helped excavate in northern Israel today called Banias, which was Caesarea Philippi in Jesus' day, and Peneus at one time dedicated to the god Pan. But of course, this site was right at the foot of Mount Hermon, which was basically ground zero for the Watchers and the creation of the giants. And uh, I, I encountered questions that I couldn't really answer in my dissertation, so that they turned into these essays that I collected in this book, Interview with the Giant, that mm-hmm. deal with these anthropological models. And I kind of took a cue from classical scholars back in the mid-20th century who were taking a cue from anthropologists in the field and began to apply those models to Greek and Roman history. I'm thinking of people like Ward Fowler, who wrote a lot on Roman religion, and in particular Moses Finley, who wrote a book called The World of Odysseus, in which he read Homeric literature, you know, the Iliad and the Odyssey and the Homeric hymns, as an anthropologist would kind of read an interview transcript. And he saw what he could glean from it. And what he found out is that the imagery that Homer was using was not necessarily the Mycenaean era Greeks, but it was the late Dark Age, early archaic period in Greek history. Imagery that he was using, whether it was economics or politics or the boar tusk helmets or the swords, the figure eight shields, that's all later stuff. That's not necessarily Mycenaean. And so by using anthropology, he was able to gain these new insights on the process of writing that literature and what Homer was using. And I thought, that's a really interesting approach. And I thought, if I could apply that same sort of logic, that same sort of methodology to the accounts of giants in the Bibles, that I might be able to glean some additional information. And I did, and I collated it and put it into this book, Interview with the Giant.
Mm. Wow. Where are your current studies brought you to?
Well, my current studies are bringing me, to using these anthropological models. I just finished a book called The Nephilim Dossier, which is a kind of continuation of this methodology. One of the essays, I'm arguing for a science of giantology. You know, if we can have conjectural sciences like astrobiology and xenoarchaeology, where we can't actually do that in the laboratory or in mm-hmm. the field, mm-hmm. Then this pursuit of a question along scholarly basis should be a valid one. I'm also working on a book with another archaeologist, Dr. Aaron Judkins, a book on Göbekli Tepe and the Bible, what implications it might have for the biblical world. As I said, I've devoted all of my time now to the Institute of Biblical Anthropology. Mm-hmm. I teach classes through the Institute as well. People can check that out if they want to.
Mm-hmm. Is that on your website?
Go ahead.
Is that on your website, that link?
There should be a link on there. People can go to the Institute website, which is tioba.org, and they can check out all the classes. There are actually a lot of articles about giants and biblical anthropology on the IBA site, too. Mm-hmm. So, we've got a huge conference coming up, the Sons of God, Giants of Old conference, which is a convocation of giant researchers on August the 16th and 17th in Lubbock.
Mm-hmm. Is Derek Gilbert going to be there?
Go ahead.
Is Derek Gilbert going to be there?
Derek and Sharon will be there.
Wow.
We got some heavy hitters. It gets bigger and bigger every year.
Well, you know, again, it's so new, it's fresh, because it's sort of been withheld, that information. So I think people are hungry. Yeah. For that kind of information, because it's rewriting history, but it's really not, and that's a misnomer, really. It's telling the history, the history that's been hidden. And let me ask you something. When it comes to the mounds that are found out through the United States, are you one to believe that some were burial grounds for these giants?
I think probably so. I've argued that the Americas hold probably some of the best physical evidence for the existence of giants. I think that even in my home state in Texas, there have been some really significant finds. There's a place called Morehus Mound down on the coast by Victoria, Texas, in which no less an organization than the Texas Archaeological Research Lab at the University of Texas got involved in. And the specimens that they uncovered were 8 feet tall. And they, in the report, they never would use the word giant. They kept referring to the remains as robust. But when the average height of Native Americans in this particular time was 5.5 feet, 8 feet tall without any indication of pituitary disease, you're not really dealing with the conventional human skeleton here. Mm-hmm. But that being said, there are, you know, I still contend that archaeological physical evidence is the sparsest of the evidences that we have, but it does exist, and I think the Americas holds a lot of potential. Both North America and South America hold a lot of potential.
So you could do some archaeological digs right here in good old U.S. of A.
Right here.
You know, one of these days, man, I'm going to take a shovel. I'm going to go to these one of these mounds at night, and I'm going to dig in there. I'm going to find out what's in there.
Don't tell me that, and don't tell the state archaeological offices either.
they won't be happy. I'm just trying to help them out.
Well, yeah, you know, the thing is, you know, if it's public land, of course you need to, you need permits, but you know, private land, you
go
can
at
do
it.
All the excavation you want. Mm-hmm.
Well, Doctor, you knew you were coming on the program tonight. Have we covered any topic that you thought we were going to cover? I want to make sure we cover any topic that you thought we were going to talk about. I want to cover that. What do you got?
Well, we've covered a lot of them, actually. You know, probably the only thing I would add to that is that, you know, the pre-flood world is a really interesting world, and we're learning more and more about it. We know a good deal about it now. The more we learn about that era of the late Pleistocene, the more we find evidence for this cataclysm that happened that mm-hmm. essentially wiped the slate clean. You know, this worldwide flood is something that's again perennial in world mythology. You're hard pressed to find a culture that doesn't have a variation on the theme of the story of Noah's flood. But in the late Pleistocene, there were huge climactic changes taking place. You know, you're coming off the end of an ice age. There's really, really crazy solar flare activity, so much so that in some parts of the Earth's surface, it vitrified the rock. We can tell that in the archaeological record. You have these periods of, because of the solar activity and because of the warming temperatures, rather oddly enough, you have these periods of flash freezing and flash flooding. And when you combine all this together, when you've got this, you know, rise in sea level because of the melting ice, the glaciers and whatnot, and all of this just crazy climactic activity that's taking place. That's a worldwide flood. And it, you know, geology is bearing it out. You know, you're probably hardly ever going to see it couched in those terms. You know, nobody's ever probably going to come out and say, in the mainstream anyway, that this is Noah's flood. But something happened at the end of the Pleistocene that just, mm-hmm. you know, it was a worldwide cataclysm.
Well, Doctor, I know you've fielded this question before, so I'm going to ask it. Obviously, it seems there was a technologically advanced pre-flood world, and some people say there were four of them, actually, four of those, and they each got destroyed and whatnot. That's irrelevant to this question, but why would we not find more, you know, whatever device they used to travel, and, you know, tools and computers? And by the way, speaking of that, this has to be an internet hoax, because in my kind of study of various things, of ancient artifacts found, that somebody said they found a device that looked like an iPad and it was fossilized somehow, and they actually got it to turn on and they saw people in period clothing on it. So I mean, I think, okay, that don't sound right. But why wouldn't we find more of their technology?
Well, one of the archaeological axioms that I've lived with, even even on the conventional stuff that I've worked on, like I worked on Spanish colonial sites and Native American sites. Absence of evidence is not always evidence of absence. The surface of the earth is vast, and we only have about a fourth of it that's exposed to us right now. And only a fraction of the earth's crust has been excavated into. When you put that in terms of statistics and probability, you know, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. And when we find something, even in even conventional archaeological finds, they're almost happy accidents. Now, that's not to say that those happy accidents don't lead to successive seasons of or years even of field work, but I would say that we probably have found some. We just may not know what we're looking at. Mm-hmm. You know, on a bare bones level, we know that lithic, your stone technology, was available at the time, but that may not have only been flint knapping and making spear points and knives and arrowheads out of flint and chert and obsidian. It could have involved, you know, we're learning more about the piezoelectric qualities of rocks and things like that. Mm-hmm. There could have been portions of our mind that we used at that time that we don't use anymore. All of these things in conjunction could have meant a body of knowledge and a kind of technology or stone, you know, stone computers, crystal computers. We know mm-hmm. that crystals are used in radios and electronics like that. So again, at the end of the day, we have to kind of say we don't know. That's not just a safe position. That's a valid scientific position to say. A lot of times, all we can do is conjecture and speculate as to what that must have been. But there was a technology that's been lost. We have to admit that.
Mm-hmm. Library of Alexandria. Do you think before they burnt it up to fuel the bathhouses for the Romans, do you think it had records of that technology?
It's hard to say. Maybe. I think some of the things that have survived give us a peek into that world, such as Plato's Timaeus and Critias, where he talks about Atlantis. Coincidentally, the destruction of Atlantis, if we're to believe Plato's account from Solon, lines up with the end of the Pleistocene era that I was just talking about. So I think that, you know, Atlantis, whatever it was also destroyed in the same cataclysm. But as to your question, yeah, I think that there's a, you know, who knows what was in Alexandria.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doctor, we've come to the end of the broadcast. I appreciate you coming on. Any final statements you want to say?
Well, I appreciate the chance to come on. I'm sorry we had some technical difficulties on my part at the beginning, but if everybody would check out the websites, and I've got a special on the classes right now. They can take all 10 of them for $200. Sons of God Conference, all the information's up on the website there, and again, thank you very much. This was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay, can we have you on again sometime?
Absolutely, anytime.
Okay.
Anytime.
Dr. Burton, I really appreciate you coming on the broadcast. We'll speak again.
Okay, indeed.
All right, bye-bye.
Godspeed.
All right. Hey, everybody.